We're going to start in about 30 seconds. So go get all your friends outside and tell them to come on in. I can blink the lights. Okay. Yeah. So let's get started if we can. My name is David Blank Edelman. I'm from Northeastern University, and I am this year's program chair. And I'd like to welcome... Thank you. And I would like to welcome you to the Bernstein Bar Mitzvah. Yeah! Jonathan, yes, exactly. Perfect, exactly. Jonathan has worked very hard for this moment, and he's feeling ready. Or alternatively, what I really want to do is tell you five secrets of the LISA program chair. They want me to get up and give opening remarks, but I want to give away the store. So I'm going to try to give you some of the things that they don't really ever tell you. Okay? So let's start with number one. First, it is only a conference if you guys show up. So I wish to thank you for being here. Because if you don't show up, well, it's kind of not nearly as interesting. Okay? Secret number two of the conference chair. I am just the bozo in charge. But there is no way I could possibly have done this without some help from other people who are not necessarily bozos. Like the USENIX board. I would like to thank them for all their support. I would like very much to thank our sponsors. Without our sponsors, we wouldn't be here, or we would all be sitting in a very small room. I'm sure, as it goes. Okay, and I would like to take a moment to thank the program committee, and I'm going to bring the lights back up again for that one. So, whoa. May I suggest you throw it far from you? I saw that one with a phaser overheated, you know. And I know what happens on that one. Okay, so would you be so kind, if you are in the room, to please stand up when I say your name, because I would like to have you appreciated by the other people in the room. Jerry, are you here? Some people may not be here yet. You don't see him. Okay, he's teaching. Well, yeah, he's always teaching. Strata, also teaching. It's amazing how people are doing their stuff without being here. Lee Damon, is he here? Yes, there he is. Rudy. Joe Gross, unfortunately, is in Chicago due to a family unpleasantness situation thing. Tom Limicelli. Rowan Littell. Rowan is here. And if, in fact, you like the Hit the Ground Running track, you should thank him doubly because he put a lot of effort into that. Tom. Is Tom here? Tom Reed? Okay. Is Yi Min here? Did I see Yi Min? He's got to be here someplace. Yes, he's way back there. Thank you. David Williamson? Yes, no, maybe? Nope. Okay. And then I'd like to also thank Elizabeth Zwicky, and I don't know if she's here. There she is, and there's Opal. If you like the Solve My Problem board, she's the person who has helped make that possible. So I'd like to thank them. Now, there are other people involved also in this organizing thing. And the reason why I'm spending some time here is this is literally all the thanks they get besides what they hear from me. You know, it's not, you know, they all have been working and working and working, and I want to make sure that they get some acknowledgement. So we have the invited talks coordinators, Adam Moskowitz, and I don't see Bill. Is Bill here? Nope. Oh, he is here. Oh, there he is, Bill. Bill may be standing up again later. Do we have Philip? Philip, our guru coordinator? Yes, way down the back. Thank you, Philip. Luke? Luke, are you in the room? Yes. Is Moose present? Esther Filmer. Nope, I don't see Moose. I also want to thank David Nolan. Is he back there? I'm pretty sure. Yes, he's way in the back. Oh, hi, Moose. Hi there. And this is David Nolan. So if, in fact, you think it's very cool that this year we have A, B, and G wireless access points and the fact that we're monitoring the network very heavily, that's thanks to this gentleman here. Joe and Laura, as I told you, couldn't be here. And Rob is not here as of yet, but he has done some amazing things, both with the proceedings and just being a general inspiration. And when you see him, you should thank him, because a lot of cool ideas that are at LISA come from him. And the talk show, right. Now, here's another secret. Here's an extra secret. I know I said I'd only give you five, but an extra secret is this. So you might have noticed that the program chairs only serve 1 year, and they've never done it before. Now, somehow, LISA gets to be as good as it is. Now, granted, the program chairs are, you know, give or take me, you know, really competent people. But it is the case that if you want to know why LISA succeeds and how it does it, there is a tremendously cool crack team of people at USENIX who are helping and who are competent and who do all the amazing stuff that make LISA possible. And they deserve a standing ovation. They're in the back. You got to stand to do it. Absolutely. Okay, and so I have another quick thing, people to thank as well. I'd like to thank the authors of all the papers who submitted stuff. 54 people submitted stuff. 24 of them were accepted. The others were told, please submit again. We'd like to thank the invited talk, the hit the ground running track, and the guru speakers, since they are going to be speaking for you. And again, you know, they're doing it, you know, because they're really great people. The workshop leaders, thank you for putting on such amazing workshops the previous 3 days. And I have to thank my employer, the Northeastern University College of Computer and Information Science, because they allowed me to do this. You know, and this takes a lot of work and work away from, you know, what in theory I'm supposed to do for a living. And I'd like to thank my boss, Larry Finkelstein, as well. And finally, the one way that this actually really honestly truly happens is thanks to my spouse, who put up to, you know, put up with me and who was tremendously supportive throughout this sort of thing. So perhaps a group clap for everyone, especially my spouse. Okay, so now it's time to move on to secret number 3. So I was handed this pamphlet in the subway called I Must Tell You This, and it had a number of things printed on it, including the stuff, these slides that I'm about to tell you about now. So there are, believe it or not, even though there's stuff on the web page and the brochures, we gave out more stuff to tell you, and here it is. Okay? First off, I want to give you a few instructions. This is important. If you are speaking, even as an IT speaker or as a refereed track speaker or any other speaker, pretty please try to meet with your session chair at the end of the preceding session so everybody gets everything groovy. For BOFs, the BOF schedule is where you expect it to be on the BOF board and on the web, and if you'd like to, please host your own BOFs. There are still slots available. For WIPs, if you would be so kind as to send Moose some mail at lisa05wips@usenix.org and say you want to do a work in progress thing, that would be spiffy. And for the game show, the qualifying questionnaire can be found at the membership booth. If you'd be so kind as to return it by Friday at noon, the top scorers will qualify. Winners will be notified by posting on the message board in the registration area. And just to let you know, it is starting 15 minutes early at 3:45 this year. Okay, so those are the instructions I have to give. I also want to point out that there are some really cool things for sale, entire infrastructures you can buy, you know, take home with you, you know, that sort of thing. At the vendor exhibition, do be sure to stop in and say hello to the vendors. They love you, not just for your money. It's on Wednesday and on Thursday from noon to 7 and from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the Golden Ballroom. Social activities, because you've got to have social activities. We're all really social people, said the people sitting into looking into their laptops. Okay, first off, there is an exhibit hall Mexican fiesta ole And a Meet the Author session. Everybody is welcome. All badge holders are welcome. That's Wednesday, December 7th, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., also in that golden ballroom. And I'd also like to point out there is a Lisa holiday office party and gaming room, and that is for tech session and tutorial attendees, please. And Thursday, December 8th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Atlas Ballroom. And I'm also told to tell you that Usenix is having a bunch of conferences. Surprise, surprise, you can find these on their website if you'd like to read there. I hope you'll attend more than just this one, though. You might be spoiled by the time we're done. And now, the question you've all been waiting for, will there be another Lisa? Of course. And the next Lisa will be in Washington, D.C., in the first week of December, 3rd through 8th. If you want to know more about it, there isn't very much there, but there will be at usenix.org/lisa06. And it is my pleasure to welcome the new program chair, Bill LaFave. So if you have ideas or anything else you want to share with him, please do that. He would love to hear it. And also, I'd like to announce the new invited talks coordinators. It will be Doug Hughes and myself. So I'm back! Yes. Yes, so pretty please. We want to hear your invited talks. Okay. So, now, it's tremendously fun. This is one of the coolest things that a program chair can do. They can acknowledge good work. So it would be my pleasure to announce the winners of the best paper at LISA, which is a very hard and contended thing. And so what I'd like to do, if possible, is have Alva Kelch and Ning Wu and Henki Sunsanto come on up to accept, or if you want to accept for all of them, that would be great. Alva wrote a paper toward a cosmonaut for system administration, and he did it. Congratulations. You're most welcome. Now, Alva is a professor and has been doing this for quite a few years. So it's amazing because it turns out that it is possible to have a best paper even as a student. And so I'd like to acknowledge two student papers which are the best student papers of this year. The first is Towards an Automated Vulnerability Comparison of Open Source IMAP Servers by Chaos. Is Chaos here? Congratulations. And Reducing Downtime Due to System Maintainability and Upgrades by Shaya and Jason. Shaya is here to accept. Excellent. Congratulations. So these folks did amazing work, and you know, look for the movie coming to a theater near you based on these papers. I hear they've been optioned. So let us move on, if we might, to some awards. It is my pleasure to turn over the podium briefly to Doug Hughes.
This year's awards are a cooperative endeavor between Sage and LOMSA in presenting these awards, and I'm very pleased to present them on that behalf. The first award is the Outstanding Achievement Award. This annual award goes to someone whose professional contributions to system administration community merit special recognition. Back in 2001, a book was published, and this book is widely recognized even today as the gold standard for system administration and network administration, and it is aptly named The Practice of System and Network Administration. The authors of that book, we thought, deserved special recognition for their contributions to the system administration community. And one of the authors is here today to accept for both of them. And he's sitting over here. Stand up, Tom. Tom Limoncelli. His co-author is Christine Lear, and she couldn't be here today, unfortunately, but Tom will be accepting on behalf of them both. Tom, as well as publishing this book, has managed to also contribute numerous tutorials, IT sessions, attend a workshop. He's basically booked up this week, so He graciously took some time out of his schedule to accept this award, and we're very happy he could do so. And Christina is working on Formula One race cars, probably right now on the track, tuning an engine out there. So these are really nice looking awards. I'll hold them both. No, and I could never be. Tom.
Thank you so much. Christine really wishes that she could be here, but this is the week where all the aerodynamic designs have to be in before they get tested. She's now one of the designers on the BMW Formula One race team in Switzerland. I kid you not. Three quick things. Christine and I thank you all for this award. We are profoundly, profoundly humbled. Sociologists say that communities pass knowledge from generation to generation by telling their stories. We didn't set out to win any awards. We just wanted to share our stories. Two. This book emphasizes the importance of repeatable processes. So, like our conchairs did, I'd like to give you our formula for success, or really my formula of success, since, well, you'll see. See, first, you just have to be an average guy from New Jersey with a pretty good idea. Next, you find a co-author that is immensely smarter than you. Like Christine Hogan, then find an editor that believes in your vision and promises to hold your hand through the long, dark journey, the scary process of creating a 700-page book, someone like Karen Getman at Addison Wesley. Lastly, have a support network of friends, proofreaders, significant others, and other people that are just second to none. Do all of this, and it's pretty easy to write a book. Third, this book is a reflection of Sage and Lopsa. We wrote what we know, and what we know we learned from people that are all members of Sage and Lopsa. Every time I open the book to a page or a chapter, I'm instantly reminded of the person who I learned that information from. And all of those people are members of this organization. These organizations, whether it's a mentor, a coworker, or a friend. Thus, if this book is any kind of outstanding achievement, it is simply because Sage and Lopsa are an outstanding achievement. So thank you very much, and I look forward to the future of both organizations. Thank you.
The second award is an annual award as of this and last year, and it's a memorial award for Chuck Yerkes, who was known to provide excellent contributions to the community, and thus the Chuck Yerkes Award is an award to recognize an individual who provides significant meritorious contributions to the community at large in member forums such as mail lists, IRC channel, etc. This year's award winner is Brandon Alberry, who's sitting in the front row over here. And I'm happy, as last year's Chuck Yerkes Award winner, to present to this year's Chuck Yerkes Award winner. Don't put any fingerprints on it, and it'll last a very nice long time and look pretty.
I just want to say thank you, and that I am just doing what I do.
Okay. So now I get to try to be nearly as articulate as Tom, which is going to be a really problematic thing, but I'll do my best. Okay, so number five. The hardest program task chair, and this is what I'm going to leave you, the hardest thing that I have had to do as part of program chair. Okay, you might think it's choosing the papers, but it's not. You might think it's planning this whole program that you're about to experience. That's not true at all. Really, the hardest thing, you know, is not even coordinating the tracks, making sure that nobody speaks at the wrong time, and other stuff like that. Really, it's choosing the theme for the conference. Now, does anybody in the room actually know what the theme is for this year? Good, because I didn't pick one. And do you know why? Because it's hard. And do you know why it's so hard? Well, here. Last year was easy, okay? Last year what we had, let me make sure that this, that my volume is up on the audio. Good, okay. So last year we had the pleasure, the last time we were in San Diego, okay, so I thought I'd start there. How many people here were in San Diego 2 years ago? Okay, so then you remember that the sun looked like this. This picture was taken by Dan using no filter. He just pointed at sun, which is typically a bad thing to do. And that's the way it looked. And so it was going to be a lot easier if it was like that, because then I could at least pick a theme song like this. What's up? Or alternatively, which I think would have actually worked better for this crowd, would be this one. Pretty please. Please start. Sound familiar? No, I'm not going to dance. Okay, I will. Now, if that wasn't going to work, I was going to be a softie, and I was going to come up with, you know, the Jerome Kern song, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, you know, which has this lovely thing, and it ends, you know, when your heart's on fire, you must realize smoke gets in your eyes. And then I came upon this clip art, and I thought, no. No, I'm not going to use that. So what to do for this year, okay? So for this year, it got really hard, okay? So one of the things, so I talked to everybody I could, and one of my staff suggested this, Lucy 2005 Underwater Aquatic Fantasy, but then I was kind of concerned that that would be a little too foretelling or something, right? And so luckily I didn't do that, but then I thought, well, you know, if we're on that path, then, you know, I'm just going back to my Jewish background here, why don't we do, nope, no locusts this year? You know, I mean, if we can't get that sort of stuff. So I continued looking, and then, you know, I got very lucky. I got very lucky because there was this whole thing that went on mailing lists between these organizations. I don't know if you've heard of them. And I thought, okay, I can work from that. And so I went and I bought this video. It looks like this. You know, and you know, and I thought, you know,
when you're a jet all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, let them do what they can. You've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own. When company's expected, you're well protected. Then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you stay a jet.
And then an unfortunate thing happened. Everybody played nice. There was no rumble. I couldn't even do that Be Cool song, you know, Be Cool Boy, you know, that I couldn't even do that. So I had to look further, and this was kind of annoying. So I went back and looked to a past. I went to Microsoft Tech Ed in 1997, and I'm sitting there in the audience of 6,000 people, and I'm listening, and I'm thinking, hey, I recognize that song that they're playing right before they start.
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And we know what we're knowing, but we can't say what we've seen.
Yes, that's really true. I'm not making that one up. And so I thought, well, that might be a hint. That might be useful. So here it is, using my best Lawrence Lessig style, a brief passion exhortation. And this is the last thing I get to say to you as program chair before I get the chance to introduce our speaker. So here's the deal. This is my Obi-Wan Kenobi speech, because I think only you guys, you know, only you can help. I need the people in this room to save the world. I mean that totally seriously. I think the world really needs saving around now. I think you are a bunch of incredibly smart people. I think that every day you make little decisions that affect either one person's lives or millions of people's lives as you are trying to get technology to work for people. And I'm hoping that you will remember that, that you're trying to get technology to work for people. I'm hoping that you will remember that you are smart and that you have power in this world and you have the ability to make things better. And that you will do your very best to do that. Because I don't know of anybody I'd rather have do that. My colleagues, my friends, I think that you are the people to save the world. And I really hope that you will do that. And that's what I want to say. You are the people who this cartoon was made for, okay? It says at the bottom, if you can't read it, break something. Okay? Some from license from the New Yorker. And that's the way I feel about it, folks. I really do. I think that you can help save the world. And I hope that you will take the time and that you remember and keep the presence of mind to do just that. Because if there's anybody that's going to do it, it's you. And that's what I have to say before it's time to introduce there. So I want to thank you for this wonderful year of being able to work to get this conference going. Please to enjoy it. It has been wonderful for me. And I'm hoping it is equally as good for you. And it is now my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Chi Lu, who is the Vice President of Engineering at Yahoo Incorporated.
Hello?
Yes, it works. Thank you, David, for the introduction. And I'm honored to be here to give this talk this morning. So the title of the talk is about scaling search beyond the public web. And I will start with the billion-dollar question. As we all know, search is the buzz. And it is also big business, and it generates a lot of value for companies such as Google and Yahoo. And everywhere you go, people talk about search, for example, in today's event. And the question often comes up is, what's next for search? And at Yahoo, we believe the best way to predict the future is actually to create it. And here's what I'm going to talk about. First, I will talk about, from a user's perspective, what is Yahoo's vision for search? And particularly, the evolution from searching the public web to searching the personal web and social search. And then I will talk about from a technological perspective, what's the difference? What are the challenges? And specifically focus more on the system deployment side, on scalability, and on issues such as fault tolerance, metrics, and monitoring. And then I will spend a little bit of time to talk about the specifics of algorithms and methods for solving some of the two of the hard core problems for social search, which is access and the visibility control, and do fast joins for class of application we call the mashups. First, I'll start with Yahoo's vision for search. And it can be summed up in just one word. It's called a FUSE. It's actually an acronym for four verbs: find, use, share, and expand. Our vision statement is to enable people to find, use, share, and expand all human knowledge. For find, that's what search engines do. And it's helping users to find the information they're looking for. And as we all know, finding information is often a means to achieve an end. And it's better to go a step further to help the user to use the information they found, whether it's to download an MP3 file of a song or to make a purchase online. And we believe we can take a step even further, which is to enable users to share what they found and to share their knowledge with the people they are connected with. And the sharing can be done writing blogs, writing reviews, tagging documents, share that via trusted network. And along this process, more knowledge gets created, and it goes through the cycle of available for finding, using, and sharing. And this creates a virtuous cycle, a process whereby the scope of all human knowledge continuously being expanded. And along the way, all our users get the benefit. So with that perspective in mind, we view search as a drama that's played out in three acts. The first act is about searching information on the public web. And the Yahoo, and specifically the Yahoo directory, started more than 10 years ago, is actually a pioneer in that space. The first search engine that searches Yahoo directory is written by David Filo, one of our co-founders. And the company legend has it that that search engine actually has very little code base in it. It's got only one small file called the main.c. And the reason it's got not a whole lot of code in it is because it calls grep to do most of its work. So as you can imagine, the search results are listed in alphabetical orders instead of ranked by relevance. And that is why in the early days of the web, people are fighting hard to get domain names that start with letter A, AA, AAA. And that's because these people try to gain some unfair advantages of being listed higher on Yahoo search results. And as we all know, time has changed big time. And today, search engine from companies such as Yahoo, Google, and Microsoft collectively all have done an effective job of helping the user to find the information on the public web. The second act is personal search. It is caused by the growth and the acceleration of the growth of personal digital content, whether they are emails, documents, photos, playlists, browse history, you name it. And it is increasingly to the point whereby finding information in your mailbox is actually more difficult than hunting information on the public web. And that is why we are seeing a new class of personal search products coming to the marketplace to help the user to tame the information explosion in their personal web. And I'll give a specific example of how that works in large scale. Act 3 is something we call a social search. And that is driven primarily by the continued strong growth of online communities, and particularly the information sharing within those communities via activities such as tagging and sharing those information with trusted network. Social search tries to tap into the metadata that's created by those communities, such as tags, and look at the trust network relationships between the users and find out computational means to discern the quality of such metadata. And we believe as the usage continues to grow, when it reaches critical mass, there will be genuine opportunities for us to materially improve the search result quality and the entire search experience. And again, I will give a specific example to show how that works. Now I'm going to talk about Yahoo Mail. Why? Because it's actually a very good example to show how personal search works in large scale online. Yahoo Mail is the largest web mail service provider on a global basis. That's according to the metric reports by Comscore and the MediaMetrix. And the total number of user base on a global basis in 21 languages and countries is more than 227 million. And on any given day, we have several billions of messages coming in. And cumulatively, this system manages several petabytes of data. And a search as a feature is actually very key for the continuous growth of usages of webmail services online. And that's because we are witnessing the fast growth rate of mailbox size. If you recall, just a year or 2 years ago, the average webmail service providers give you several megabytes of storage. Nowadays, you can easily get gigabytes of storage. As users have more messages in their mailbox, search becomes increasingly important to help them to find the information they want. So this is a screenshot that explains some of the core features of Yahoo Mail search. And as you can see on the upper right-hand side corner, there's a search box. And by default, it does prefix matching and search across the headers, the body, and attachment content of mail messages. And the main chunk of this page shows the search results. And for search results, we do things such as hit highlighting and dynamic snippets that helps user to quickly preview and scan the search results. And the user can even mouse over a particular hit to find out more information. On the left-hand side of this page, there's a set of options that helps the user to refine the search result set. It can be done based on senders, photos, attachments, message status, or by dates. At the top of this page, we also provide a couple of search views. One is a photo view. And the reason we do that is because photos, it turns out, are the most frequently used attachment document types for webmail services. And we also provide an attachment view. And this is what you get if you click on the photo view. And as we can see, this literally turns a user's mailbox into a photo album. And we added additional features to make it easier for the user to manage their photos. And at the same time, on the left-hand side, the user can continue to drill down based on senders, message status, etc. This is the attachment view. And in order to help the user to preview and scan search results, we also computed a image thumbnail for each attachment document. So by now we have seen the core set of search features for Yahoo Mail, And I would like to point out, this is a very good example of personal search on the web, not only because it represents the state of practice right now, but also it can be a good example to tell us what the future may look like. And there are several reasons for that. The first is really the size of the scale. As far as we know, search for Yahoo Mail perhaps is one of the largest, if not the largest, search application that's ever built. And the second is the real-time nature of it. Every incoming message is searchable right away, and you don't have to even open it. And every update to photos, message status, are also immediately reflected on search results. And the third, which is more important, is the diversity of document types in a user's mailbox. The reality is, for a large number of users, they use their webmail as an online repository for all kinds of objects, photos, documents, receipts, you name it. So by providing good search capabilities to help them find the information they want also provides an environment for us to observe how users use it. And that can help us to understand the user behavior and understand what the future for large-scale personal search online application may look like. Next, I will give a product example for social search. And this is the product we call the MyWeb 2.0 that's launched a short while ago. And there are several elements in this page. This is the home page of that product for a registered user. At the top of this page, you can see a search box, but the difference is it's got two search buttons. The first button is the search my web button. And the search will be conducted against the documents that are saved by the users of MyWeb 2.0 into that product. And the access permission of those saved documents are set in such a way they are visible to this user. And the search web button will bring a regular web search results. And there are three sections here to help the user to use this product. The first section are designed to help the user to manage personal knowledge. It includes links to all the saved web pages or the tags that are associated with those saved documents. The second section is designed to help the user to manage the community's shared knowledge. And there's one thing that is important I would like to point out is a link pointing to a list of user contacts. And those are the other users this user invited as friends to join MyWeb 2.0 search community so that they can share their search experience. And there's a link pointing to all the documents that are saved by those users on the friends list, and the access permission is set in such a way that these documents are visible to this user, and then all the tags that are associated with those documents. The last section provides links point to all the publicly visible saved documents and also the tags that are associated with those documents. MyWeb 2.0 also provides a set of tools and capabilities, and one of them is to make it easier for users to save documents and tag them into MyWeb 2.0. For example, if you would like to save this LISA 2005 conference webpage into MyWeb 2.0, you can use the MyWeb toolbar or a bookmarklet or a button that you can place on website. And when you do the saving, there will be a screen pop-up that allows you to type in extra information. For example, you can name your own title, add notes and annotation, and associate tags. And we also automatically suggest some of the relevant tags for the users to enter. The user can also choose access permissions when saving this document. The access permission can be either private, only visible by this user, or can be shared with the friends on the contact list. Or the document can be chosen to be visible by everybody. And the user can also specify whether to save a copy of this page or only save the link. This is a search result page if you use the search the web button in my Web 2.0 product. And the query here is Lisa. And there are three sections on this search result page. The top section is something we call the shortcuts. And in this case, there's some news article matches for this query. And the second section searches documents that are saved in my web that are visible to me. And there's a total of 41 matches. And the search section are the regular web search results. And as you can see, the regular web search results is quite diversified because the term Lisa can have different meanings, can be the name of a person, can be the name of a project or a organization. Therefore, the results reflect that. But this is what I get if I hit the search my web button. And relative to my bias, I can say this is materially more relevant search results because each of those matches are all about documents about the Lisa Usenet conference. And the magic here is the community because people on my friends' contact list are mostly technical people. Some of them are interested in the Lisa conference and they save the documents and tag documents. Therefore, they show up when I search it. And when a user's personal bias and the community bias are aligned in this case, you can see there's a material difference on the quality of the search results. And this example illustrates the potential opportunities here because when there's critical mass, when there's a lot of usages, there's good reason to believe we can significantly lift the quality of search results for a lot of users. And this page is a management console page for the users to manage information in the personal web. And there are three tabs that reflect three types of first-class citizen objects in this universe. The page that are saved by the user, the tags that are associated with those pages, and the contacts on the user's friends list. And in the middle of the page, there's tools and capability for the user to edit the saved documents and manage those collections. MyWeb is also an interesting place to discover popular and useful information. And this is an example of a tag map. And the font size of the tags are proportional to the degree of popularity of each tag. Therefore, visually, it is very important, it's very easy for the user to quickly see what's popular and what's interesting. To further help the user to discover new and interesting information on Web 2.0, we also support RSS. So a user can use a RSS feeds reader to subscribe to information in MyWeb 2.0. For example, you can subscribe any tags so that documents that are tagged by the subscribed tag and future documents will be automatically delivered to your reader. And you can subscribe to any particular user or search query or combination of them. And we also support Firefox Live Bookmark. To recap the highlights of all the features of MyWeb 2.0, it is really designed to encapsulate the product vision that we have. For search, we provide capabilities that enable users to search personal knowledge and the community's shared knowledge, and to discover quality information via trusted network. For use, we provide developer APIs, IS, and save to my web buttons. For sharing, this product enables users to invite their friends to join a search community, share the search experience. And it also enables users to share saved links or saved documents via email or instant messenger. For expansion, it supports tagging and annotation at this stage. And it is important to point out this is a very early stage beta product. And there's a lot of future innovations, new product features coming down the product pipeline. So far, I have talked about, from user's perspective, what is personal search and what is social search. Now let me talk about, from a technological perspective, what's different and what's challenging. There's many differences here. First, personal search and social search are read-write applications instead of read-only, like searching the public web. It also has high-level requirements for data consistency, integrity, and durability. And that's not the case for public web search. For indexing, everything has to be done in real time. And for web search, you can do it in offline and batch mode. It also requires access control and visibility control, and also needs to provide a rich user application interface that requires workflow. And perhaps the biggest difference of all is the degree of scale. For public web search, we view that as one-dimensional. We call it B-scale search because you have billions of documents. Scaling for public web search is just to make sure your system can expand efficiently as the number of documents grows. For personal search and social search, it's got two dimensions. You've got billions of documents that are out there, and you've got potentially billions of users interacting with those documents. And the product needs to capture those interactions. Therefore, potentially we have to deal with a huge B times B matrix that's very sparse, but still it takes scaling to the next level. So as we all know, the common techniques for scaling are partitioning and replication. If we were to revisit the three acts of a search evolution, you can see for the first act, searching the public web or managing the growth of public knowledge, it can be primarily done by partitioning by URL. To manage the growth of personal knowledge, the natural choice would be partitioning by user. To support the growth and the scale of shared knowledge and social search, we need to have partitions in two dimensions, user and the URL. And this is a picture view of a common architecture for scaling public web search or public knowledge. And it's got two dimensions in it. The first dimension is scaling for the growth of the web, and that's usually done by partitioning by URLs. And you cut your search index into smaller pieces, and as the web grows, you just add more partitions to it. The second dimension is to scale for the growth of traffic, and that's usually done by replications. Typically, to make it easier, we replicate the entire index rather than a portion of the index. And it's often the case we put multiple replicas in a single colo and have a number of colos that are geographically distributed, so that when a query comes in, we map the user to a colo that's geographically closer to the user and pick a replica from that colo and let that replica serve the query. And that replica will send the query to all the partitions, and the query will be executed in parallel, and the result will be aggregated and sent back to the user. And all these can be done in a small fraction of a second. The gameplay for scaling personal search is quite different from our experience so far. And we believe there's opportunity to introduce a new system abstract that can help to make the scaling easier. And this is something we call a personal locker. A personal locker is a collection of digital objects that are owned and managed by a single user. A locker can contain any objects, documents, photos, mails, calendar events, contacts, tags, annotations. And a locker is also designed to be the database layer for all personal search applications. The application logic and the presentation logic all sits on top of that layer of abstraction. And we provide two interfaces for that abstraction. The first interface has three main components. The first component is managing the repository and the updates of those objects. And the second component is to provide associative retrieval capabilities so that you can find those objects based on the content in those objects. And it provides what we call a fusion capability, which is really search over joins of documents. For example, you join email with attachment, join saved web page with annotations. And there's many examples of that. And the third component, it provides fast aggregation capabilities. The second interface provides administrative operations, particularly autonomous fault tolerance and the resource provision. With that abstraction, we do three types of activities to scale personal knowledge or personal search. First is partitioning. In this case, there's natural locality of data and operations that are centered around the owner of the data. So therefore, it's natural to partition by user. And the unit of partitioning in this case would be personal locker. And we're partitioning within a colo and across colos based on geographic proximity. And second, we do replication as well. And in this case, replication is actually more for the purpose of providing data durability for tolerance, not just for scalability. The third is to provide autonomous management capabilities for growth. Specifically, what we do is we group a collection of personal lockers into a unit, something we call a cell. And a cell is a baseline unit that we map a cluster of machines to provide computing resources to. So all personal locker operation will be applied against a cell. The cell will grow as the usage grows. At some point, we'll split the cell to accommodate further growth. And when split happens, we need to recompute the hash ranges and do data migration so that the data in the old cell can be moved into a new cell. And we do that by automated processes so that regular operations can continue without being disrupted. And this is a picture view of how we scale personal knowledge. We first partition the data by users into personal lockers, and then we group a collection of personal lockers into a cell within a colo. And when the user query comes in or update operation comes in, we'll pick the right colo that's geographically closer to the user, find the cell that has the personal locker for that user, and we will do that operation via the personal locker interface. Now I'm going to talk about how to scale shared knowledge for social search. Scaling shared knowledge can be done on top of scaling for personal knowledge, but it also has to do a number of things that are unique for social search. And here are some examples to illustrate the points. The first example that's very common based on what we observed so far is the users would like to find all the saved web pages in a user's community that contain certain query terms, for example, Lisa 2005. And another common operation is to find the page that are saved by everybody in my community, or find the top 100 most popular pages or the most popular tags in my community. And if we look at the niche that's common across all those popular activities in social search are three technical tasks. The first is to form a unified view across a set of users. That often requires joining across contents from personal lockers. And sometimes that needs to span geographically dispersed colos. For example, I may have friends living in China, and the data potentially would be hosted in colos over there. So that certainly poses challenges on computations and latencies. The second is manage all the user relationships and do fast computations on those relationships. And for that, we believe we can use a memory-based solutions to represent the user relationship as a graph. A node represents a user, edge represents relationships. Because there's only over 6 billion users on the globe, and on average, each given user has relationships on the order of a few hundreds. Therefore, it is possible to represent that entire graph in memory using one computing nodes or small number of computing nodes based on hardware configurations. And the scaling for that part can just replicate in those nodes. And the third is doing access control and the visibility control. And we'll spend some more time later in the talk to describe the specific method that we use. Architecturally, in order to support the scaling for social search and for shared knowledge, we introduce a new component. It's something we call a Rubik farm. It's a collection of servers that are dedicated for certain special purposes. For one, it's dedicated to maintain join tables for common user queries that are expensive because they require join across a large set of users or aggregation across a set of users. And these Rubik farm servers also perform offline computations and cache results for popular operations. The second main task for Rubik farm is to maintain additional views, particularly search indexes, in other dimensions. For example, there's many, many queries in social search applications that can be served much, much more faster if we have another search index that's partitioned based on URL rather than partitioned based on users. So the Rubik farm will be able to maintain those multiple indexes and federate queries to different views and aggregate results. And this is a picture view of how architecturally we try to scale shared knowledge for social search applications. The first thing to point out here is we partition by multiple dimensions. We partition first by users into personal lockers and group them into cells in colo. And then we partition and build search indexes that are based on partitioning by URLs. And the Rubik farms maintain join tables and other computing nodes for things such as user relationships. And collectively, all these components work together to scale the operation as the usage grows. Next, I'm going to talk more about fault tolerance. And this is one area that personal search and social search differs most from public web search because we cannot lose data. And we cannot have a node down when the user comes in looking for documents that are sitting on that node. And that's not the case for web search. And I would like to talk about two things here. One is a multi-level approach for replication and a failover. We use some homegrown technologies that can provide pretty robust data replication and failover at the node level and at the cluster level. And then we do cross-colo replication and cross-colo failover. And for cross-colo replication, we try to get the latency to be near real-time as much as we can. And we also have a system component to something we call a Stargate. Its primary job is to handle cross-colo replications. And there's two sides of it, the inbound part and the outbound part. The outbound task for a Stargate is to aggregate all the update transactions from all the nodes within a colo. It will sort all those transactions, order them by timestamps, and then group these transactions by users. And then we'll send a collection to another colo and received by the Stargate of the other colo. And that starts the inbound part of the task, which is primarily replay transactions. And at the same time, we also can run application code along the process. The next thing I want to talk about is self-healing capabilities. For the scale that we deploy those personal search and social search applications, failure of nodes is the norm rather than exceptions. So anytime a node fails, the degree of redundancy is reduced, and the likelihood of having a successful failover is also reduced. Therefore, we must have automated means to rebuild nodes out of a sparing supply pool of hardware and deploy them in serving rotations based on configuration in automated ways. And we also rebuild search indexes as part of that process. Next, I'm going to talk about a little bit about metrics and monitoring, which is very, very key on how we manage the large-scale deployment of such systems. And for that, we focus on the following activities. First is to log quite a bit of data that reflects system-level performances. And then we also focus on building very lightweight instrumentation capabilities so that we can log application behavior data. And all those logged data are pulled in real time into some central nodes, put into database so that we can run query on those data. And that sets the foundation for us to build a set of real-time monitoring capabilities that can trigger different events. The monitoring event can be triggered based on system-level information that can tend to give signals on some key components may be failing, or can be based on application behaviors. And for that, we focus on using historical data to find fairly reliable patterns and use those patterns to establish tight bonds for triggering events so that we can trigger events that does not have a lot of false alarms in it, but at the same time, there's a high degree of confidence that we're not missing important signals. Once those monitoring events are triggered, we use an internal set of diagnostic tools, and usually we do slice dicing on the data that we warehoused and follow a decision tree that gives us an overall framework to systematically drill down what are the root causes of the problem we're facing. Sometimes it's pointing to system components, sometimes pointing to application malfunctions, sometimes it's a combination of those. I'm going to switch topic a little bit to talk about a central problem for social search application, which is access control and the visibility control. In the case of MyWeb 2.0 product, we have three access permission modes: private, shared, and public. And the user, the owner of the document, can set access permissions at the per object level. And access control is to make sure that users can only access to documents they have permission to access. And the visibility control gives users the capability to specify the scope of operation. For example, the user can say, I'm searching across my friends or searching across my friends of friends. But at the core of it, it's about filtering search results based on access permissions or based on scope restrictions. The technical challenge here is really twofold. One is the efficiency side, because for products like MyWeb 2.0, a user can have up to 250 friends. And to support a scoping requirements of friends, we need to consider more than 62,000 users. And that's a lot of information to consider for filtering search results. And the other aspect is flexibility, because different groups, different applications may use different access control and visibility control policies. We would like our solutions to be flexible enough so that future application does not require code changes. So the specific approach we take is a token-based approach. The sharing an object requires a sequence of activities. First, we're going to create a token for the object that are being shared. And that token encodes the user ID, which is the owner of this document, and the sharing mode. And this token is indexed into a token field for this object. And then this token is propagated to the users on the owner's friends list. And then the filtering process becomes a rather simple problem, which is giving a query Q, a user U, let's first retrieve list of token T that's possessed by this user U. We run the query for Q, get the result set, and then filter the result set using the list of tokens. And we have tried several different approaches and done a fair bit of experimentations. Based on what we have seen so far, one approach worked out reasonably well, which is to keep an in-memory object-to-token map. And this flowchart shows how that works. For a given query that has two components, the query string and a set of tokens, what we do is first we send a query to an inverted index to get a list of object ID coming back that matches the query. And then we build a hash table for the list of tokens so that lookup can be done fast. Then we go through iteration for each of the object ID in the list. For each object ID, we will retrieve a list of tokens that are associated with that object ID. And for each token, we do lookup in the hash table. If there's a hit in the hash table, we'll include this object ID in the result set. Otherwise, if none of the tokens has a hit in the hash table, we'll exclude that object ID from the result set. Now the key is how efficiently we can retrieve list of tokens and how efficiently we can use memory space to represent the map. Specifically, we use a 8-byte integer to represent a token, and using a very simple approach of a two-level array to implement the map. And this is what it looks like. To given an object ID, we can use the information associated with that ID to index into the top-level array. And the element of that array, when the first bit is set to 0, it means that this object has only one token associated with it. And the next 63 bits encode the value of that token. If the first bit is set to be 1, that means this object has multiple tokens attached to it. And then the next 63 bits will have two components, the number of tokens and the offset you can use to index into the secondary array. So as we can see, retrieving a list of tokens can be done very fast. And it turns out the size of the memory is also very small, and that's actually largely due to the nature of the application. In such a way that the distribution of tokens to objects is that a large majority of objects will have only one tokens or less associated with it. In the case of MyWeb 2.0, the object can be only associated at most with access tokens. And the reason being, in MyWeb 2.0, any documents can be only associated with one access permission value. It can be either private, shared, or public. For some other applications, such as Flickr, you can actually have multiple access tokens to an object. Because in Flickr, an image can be shared simultaneously by members of family, by members of different groups. But by and large, based on what we've seen so far, we assume it is the case whereby there's always going to be small percentage of objects will have multiple tokens associated with it. And the larger majority will have only one access token. And therefore, the size of the total memory map will be 8 bytes times the number of tokens and the number of objects that has multiple tokens. And if we are considering putting 4 million documents on a node and assuming 25% of documents or objects will have multiple tokens to it, the total amount of memory that's required is about 64 megabytes, which is reasonably affordable. Now I'm going to talk about the topic of doing fast joins for mashup applications. Mashup is something that's actually gaining more and more popular on the web. It's websites pulling together information from multiple different sources and join them together in certain fashions, and often visually overlay them to enhance the user experience. And a classic example is Craigslist overlaid on top of Google Maps. But this can be done for a variety of different applications, and what we're considering here is mostly for search result pages. Because MyWeb 2.0 as a community provides a rich set of micro content, tags, annotations, ratings, reviews for URLs. And if we take search results from a search engine such as Yahoo, Google, or Microsoft, we can overlay the micro content on those result pages to make the user experience better. So our design goal here is to provide a generic service that can do mashup for those type of applications. So given a set of URLs and given a user ID, our job here is to join that set of URLs with the micro content that's accessible by that users in the MyWeb 2.0 community. And this must be done actually in very, very tight latency bound because it's done in sequence. You cannot do that in parallel. So this just visually shows an example of a mashup of search result page. We overlay community micro content on top of Yahoo search results. And this flowchart shows logically the two joins that we need to do. given the input of 100 URLs and the user ID, for example, in this case, myself, the first join we need to do is join that 100 URLs with a table in myweb2.0 that captures the relationship between user IDs and the micro content these users created that are associated with the URL and the visibility control. Once that join is done, we use the resulting table, which is a subset of those 100 URLs that has user IDs associated with it, visibility control information, and then we join that with my contact list, my friends, my friends' friends. And the second join will produce the final result of a subset of those URLs that has users create a macro content in myweb2.0 that are visible by me. And the technical challenge here is, again, the amount of computation we potentially need to do in real time. Because, again, for each user, you can have up to 250 users on your friends list. A scope of friends of friends requires you to consider over 62,000 users. And each of those users, in worst case, can all have micro contents that are associated with URLs you try to mash up. So if we try to mash up 100 URLs, in the worst case, you may need to consider more than 6 million different possibilities. So our specific approach here is to use a memory-based lookup mechanism. We use a bitmap representation, and the purpose here is to reduce memory usage and to avoid online creation of hash tables. And this approach can also be easily distributed so that the computation can be done by multiple nodes to reduce the latency. The specific data structure and algorithm we use is Bloomfilter. A Bloomfilter is a space-efficient probabilistic bitmap that is designed for fast membership tests for a given set. This is a picture that shows how a Bloomfilter works. Given n bits, we first initialize all those bits to zero, and then we choose k hash functions. And to add one item into the set, what you do is you compute those k hash functions, and then based on the value of the hash results, you set those k bits to 1. And to test whether another item is in the set or not, what you do is, again, to run the k hash functions and verify those k bits. If there's one bit of those k bits that are not set, then you know for sure this item is not in the set. But if all those bits are set to be 1, it is possible that this item is in the set, but there's also possibility for false positive because you may have multiple items, the hash value that's mapping to the same bit. So you can actually control the likelihood of false positive by choosing different parameters of a Bloomfilter. Suppose we have n bits, and we need to host a set of n items. And if we choose the ratio of m over n to be 32, and we choose to use 9 hash functions, we can get the odds of false positive to be less than 6 out of million, which is reasonably acceptable. And in this particular application, however, actually false positive is not the end of the day, because in the end, we need to retrieve the actual micro content from personal locker. So therefore, you have an opportunity to validate whether there's a false positive match or not. Another limitation of Bloomfilter we need to overcome is that you can only add item to a set to membership test, but you cannot remove item from a set. And that's not quite enough for our applications. So we modify the algorithm slightly. So instead of hashing into a single bit, we choose to use an element and use 4 bits to serve as a counter. So the same approach pretty much applies here. So when you add an item to a set, what you do is you compute the k hash functions that map into those k elements, and then you do increments for the counters. And the way you remove item out of the set is, again, do the hash computations, and you decrement the counters. And that gives us enough flexibility to maintain the set doing the modifications that are needed. The specific mashup we do is using the following steps. First is we're going to insert a set of micro content items into the Bloomfilter. And for any micro content that are associated with a given URL, what we do is use a combination of URL, the user ID, in this case, it's the owner of this micro content, and the visibility control as a hash key. And then the join can be done by lookup through the Bloom filter. So for a given user, what we do is we iterate through the friends of this user and the friends of friends. And then for each combination of URL, the user ID, and the visibility, we compute the hash and do lookup. And for all those cases that there's positive matches, we go to the personal locker for two purposes. One is validate whether there's false positive matches or not. Then we need to retrieve the actual micro content item, whether it's tags or reviews, ratings, for the actual mashup. And we also do the Bloom filter implementation in a non-blocking way, because we have a daemon that's doing a periodic update of the Bloom filter. So when the mashup request comes in, we don't like to use a global locks to slow down the process. So what we do is we use two rotating versions of the Bloom filter so that operation can proceed without delay. So last, I would like to just comment a little bit on the memory size of this implementation. If we were to put 4 million microcontent items into a Bloom filter, and we choose a configuration of a Bloom filter where m over n is the ratio of 32, and hash, the number of hash functions is 9, we can put all these things together with less than 64 megabytes of memory. Again, that's reasonably modest for a commodity computing node. So now I would like to recap, summarize this talk. So far, I have talked about the user values and the product examples of personal search and the social search. And I talked about the technical challenges on how to scale those new applications. But this is only the beginning. Everything we do today is really the tip of the iceberg of what could be done in the future. That's why I'm grateful that I'm giving this opportunity to speak to this audience that represents a very, very important community. It is my belief there's a lot of opportunities ahead for members of this community to participate in a meaningful way. There's just a lot of emerging applications that can be developed. New technology will be built, new infrastructure, new software abstractions, common building blocks, researchers, innovations. The biggest opportunity ahead of us all is, I believe, we can work together to create a better future for searching on the internet. Thank you very much.
I've got a My Yahoo account, and I'm mostly happy with it, and you've shown me some things that I want to explore, but, you know, way back 8 years ago, or sometime when I signed up, you folks asked me if I was married, and the mortgage ads are fine, and the vacation ads are fine, but the dating service ads are a bit much. You're not providing value to your advertiser.
So this I take as a commentary rather than a question for me. So we'll be happy to talk to you offline. For now, we'll just take a ring check.
Mark Cherini, Tufts University. Dr. Liu, thank you for your talk. I had just two quick questions. Does Yahoo perceive that there is a fundamental weakness in keyword search or search as it's currently done? And if they do, what are they doing to address that, those fundamental weaknesses and the inefficiency of search by humans? I don't like to scroll. I want summary information that will pinpoint with pretty good, very good accuracy in a conceptual level, what I'm looking for. Now, that's been a topic for a long time. My second question is this. There's been a lot of work in the past 5 to 10 years on distributed storage, DHTs, and peer-to-peer storage, Ocean Store, Freenet, things of this nature. Is Yahoo considering, or have they considered, research on that for scalability purposes, content storage, security issues aside? I know that's a big part of it. Thank you.
I would answer the first questions. You used the word weakness. Would turn that around to say opportunities, because we view search holistically. Search is really a means to serve an end, which is to get the information you want and to use the information you find. It doesn't have to take the form of typing keywords and get 10 results. Clicking a link, conducting some other activity that's natural to the user is all part of it. And we believe that. We share your view, share your perspective. And it's really our job, our company's mission, to provide a rich set of services to serve our users' information needs. And that's really good questions. The second is with regard to storage technologies, a variety of different kinds, including P2P, and whether Yahoo is doing researches looking into those possibilities. The answer is absolutely yes. I would just to call out, besides Yahoo Mail, and there's a variety of the Yahoo products that requires large amounts of storage, web search being one of those applications as well. So we are keen into looking future trends and storage technologies that can help Yahoo to improve the quality that we provide to our users, and it's equally important to reduce our cost. So we are eager to reach out, work with the research community, parties in the industry to work together so that we can offer better products at a lower cost.
Good stuff. I'm Mike Jones from Microsoft. Thank you for coming. I'm also the Usenix board president in another role. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the quality of the personal searches and the social searches depend upon users providing more information, users producing my web, saving pages, forming the community of links. Do your user studies show that a large fraction of users are willing to do that or even understand the value of doing that?
Great question. So, Mike, actually, just to point to a little history, that actually I think I know you a little bit many years ago at the Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah, we did.
And we didn't have a chance to actually meet with each other after I left CMU and you left for Microsoft. I remember you were with the Mark group, right? It was way back.
Correct.
Yes. So this is a really good question. So there needs to be built-in, deep, self-serving purposes for the user to conduct those activities. With regard to personal search, I think the reason is there because as you accumulate more and more objects, your ability to recall becomes lower and lower. You need tools. So you can sort those documents into folders. That's too rigid. It doesn't scale. Putting labels and tagging in many ways is really associating recall cues, right? People usually recall objects based on who, when, where. And the people associate with where's the location that things happened, when that happened. So based on what we've seen, there's good reason to believe that type of activities users are willing to do. For social search, it's slightly different. It's part of recall, part of it also for discovery. And what I like to point out is for sites like I use, for example, Delicious. I'm a big fan of Delicious. Mm-hmm. The reason I use that is actually what's so-called the collective intelligence. I subscribe to a lot of tags on Delicious. And the documents I discover are truly of high quality because the people who are tagging those documents are usually professionals in certain communities. So there is a incent, because I also tag documents and put into Delicious, because the motivation is actually simple, because I'm getting a lot from that community. Mm-hmm. And when I choose documents, when I tag, actually I'm very careful. I only select
documents that are considered of high quality, authoritative sources, and also careful choosing the text because I need to speak the right vocabulary so that my community can tap into the work I do. So I think there's also, I would say, there's reason to believe there are self-serving reasons for users to act in a group because they get good value out of doing so.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no question that for those who participate, there's a lot of value. And the question, and I know it's still an open question, is how you educate people and how you make it easy enough for broad participation where it just is a natural activity. And, you know, we all face this. It's a good challenge.
Mike, I very much share your perspective.
Anil Somayaji, Carleton University. Is Yahoo building any privacy-enhancing technologies into their databases, like, for example, encrypted databases or other mechanisms that would prevent unauthorized, you know, users, whether in Yahoo or other agencies, from searching things they shouldn't?
The answer is very much so, because if you look at all the data that we have hosted internally for different applications, it ranges from reasonably sensitive data such as search queries to very, very private. For example, we offer bill pay services, used to offer aggregation of bank accounts. Those are the information that are very, very important. So we treat them with a set of technologies so that they can be tightly guarded and very, very secure. So the answer to your question is yes, we're looking into those technologies and we're deploying a variety of those for different application needs.
I guess related to that, still Yahoo, my Yahoo and Yahoo Mail still ask for unencrypted passwords. And I know the Yahoo Mail service, I think, still ask for unencrypted SMTP auth things. And that same password now is being used all across Yahoo. So is that going to change in the near future? Or?
So actually, I'm perhaps not in a good position to answer your question because I do the search part for Yahoo Mail, but I'm not involved in the user registration and the sign-up part of the products. So I do remember in history, in the early days of Yahoo, we let users sign in unencrypted. So there are sets of user ID internally we consider legacy IDs that are potentially can be compromised. And then we introduce secure IDs going through HTTPS for future products. That was done many years ago. But I'm not up to speed on the specific issue you raised with regard to Yahoo Mail.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Alva Couch, Tufts University. I have some students working on domain-specific validation of web pages for making link sites. We're worried about the concept of tag poisoning, which is to say someone intentionally poisoning a tag set for the purpose of commercial gain. I don't quite understand how you deal with that here, but I'm sure you do, so I wonder if you could say just a little about that.
Yeah, this is a good question. So even in a very early stage product, MyWeb 2.0, we've seen a practice of tag spams and pollution of tags, as you mentioned. So there are several different ways to look at it, and when you have a healthy ecosystem that creates value for the user, and at some point, and economic value gets created, you will have a natural adversaries. People will try to game the system, spamming, tax spam. It's just a part of the issues you have to live with it. Specifically for those cases, we can do a variety of different things. Usually, we develop competition models that give us automated means that we can compute the degree of trustworthiness of tags or web pages. And you know, if you look at the large search engines, collectively, we are able to do a decent job for that. And I think similarly, tag can be handled in a similar approach.
Thank you, Dr. Liu, for your time today. Brian Thomas. My question is about the groups, the My Community results from your MyWeb 2.0. How do you deal with the dynamism of your group? Yesterday, when I did a search, my group included my girlfriend, and so her results were included. Today, she's my ex-girlfriend. My results have changed. Is this an externality, or do you see this, and do you have a way to address this problem?
Interesting question, interesting examples. So we these are many, many important issues along with others in our scope of future product roadmap. At this day, I would say we do not have specific answers. The key is we're really in the early stages. Our position is we're going to roll some early product out, and the important thing is to be in a place to get the user to use it so that we can learn how the user uses it and have the capability to iterate fast and to figure out the sustaining patterns and over time raise the value of the product to our users.
Hi, my name is Stephen Johnson with the state of Arkansas. Alva's question sort of prompted another one for me. In terms of the tag poisoning and other issues, has Yahoo ever explored getting more meta content over what the users are building in terms of like moderating other people's tags, like the moderating system of Yahoo or /dot?
Yeah, this question I would summarize. Does Yahoo consider using moderation as a means to control the potential pollution and spans in tag space? This is certainly one possibility. If you look at how Flickr, a company that Yahoo acquired last year, maintains the healthy growth of its community, I would say moderation and editorial review is part of the game. Particularly in the early stages, you want to set the foundation right to establish a good, healthy culture for those groups, and the issue of using moderation, editorial reviews are just part of the scope of possibilities.
Guy Ferriero, CNET. Dr. Liu, this seems to describe a view of the user that is at a single point in time. Is there any thought about working with something along the lines of Gelertner's streams, time stream idea, timeline idea?
So actually, can you elaborate a little bit more? So you're saying the question is this model that I described for social search and personal search?
It describes a user at a particular single point in time.
I see.
And Gelertner has the idea of maintaining data about your data set as a timeline so that as you go, you can look back in time and see that, you know, 3 months ago, this was my set of friends. I mean, I'm sort of extrapolating his ideas into this environment.
Yeah, this is a actually also a very good question. So we do consider time as one of the important dimensions for our product feature space. And that's primarily coming from the recall side, because as you know, the human recall cues are often who, when, where. When is a very important part of how you recall things. So for personal search, for your history, being quickly able to drill down objects or documents, associations based on time dimension is absolutely something we will do as part of roadmap. The interesting challenge, I guess, opportunity, if you will, is to how to explore the time dimension in information discovery and in the social dimension side. Again, I would point to that we are really in the early stage. We don't know the answer, but these are very interesting opportunities for us to figure something out.
Thank you very much.
So David said this is the last question. I would like to again thank you all for your time this morning. It's been a tremendous experience for me.
Thank you very much. So we have a break now, and at 11 o'clock, we'll begin our stuff. If you are speaking, please find your session chair in the room you're speaking in. Thanks a bunch.